read our Bible because we're historians that say, boy, it'd be really interesting to find out, like, you know, I wonder what Moses was thinking about when he, you know, wrote to the Israelites in the wilderness, or boy, you know, I'd really just like to know, like, what was going on in the time of Daniel. It's just so intriguing to me. Like, it might be, but more than that, right, we love the Bible because God has seen fit that he speaks to us by having spoken to other people already in the past. And so we want to run through that. So last time we were together, this is what we looked at, and you did observations. Did anybody have any questions as they were looking through this? They were wondering, what would you call that? What is this? Things that stood out up there on 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 11. Again, you'll notice I can't avoid eschatology. I just love it. I think growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s, I saw so many people in the church were afraid to talk about eschatology because they thought you needed like maps and charts and, you know, we talked about that ridiculous song by DC Talk, I Wish We'd All Been Ready, and there's like fear-mongering almost about like being left behind. And so I love 1 Thessalonians because it's so different, right? It's so countercultural from what we're used to, maybe from like American, you know, evangelical eschatology or something like that, right? It's very different. Any questions that you had as you were looking up here, making observations? Things that you had questions about? I did them in order of what I gave you in that list. So notice, like, you might have found the list here. This is a big one for Paul. We call this the Pauline triad. Paul likes to talk about faith, love, and hope, right? And he switches the order based on his emphasis. So one of the things we said, when you find a list, you want to ask, like, why is my list here? Notice that hope comes last. And you could say this same list starts 1 Thessalonians. So one of the biggest points of 1 Thessalonians is Paul wants to point out that Christians have hope. Hope in their present suffering as they await the return of Jesus. So you say there's a list right there that was important. Right, notice that there are lots of proposition grounds in this passage. One of the ways that Paul's really gentle with people, kind of an ancient way to be really nice, is to say, I don't need to tell you anything about this. You guys know everything. And then what do? You go on to tell them a lot more details about that specific thing. It's a very gentle way to kind of correct or teach. So there were several proposition grounds. Right. One thing that I like to point out is this imagery of the Lord coming like a thief. Notice that it's always used for the unbeliever. In other words, the thief is the figure of speech for the unbeliever because they won't be ready. But notice he says, right, you're not in darkness for that day to surprise you like a thief, because here's the reason: you are children of light, children of the day. In other words, the believer really shouldn't talk about the return of Jesus like a thief in the night or surprising you, because Paul says you'll be ready, so don't be afraid of that. And again, he says, because that's true, because you will be ready. Notice the order. It's always, you will be ready, therefore be awake and be sober. And then he says, because those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk, get drunk at night. So again, he gives the reason for that. And again, he says, let us be sober. What is the reason for being sober? Because you already are assured that you are safe. God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation, right? So again, there's always this pattern, which is you are safe, believer, right? Now, if you're talking to an unbeliever, you'd say, watch out, right? For you, thief in the night, you don't know, you're not ready, you're not prepared. But for the believer, it's always, right, the order is you will be ready, therefore be ready, which is really encouraging. Notice there's lots of comparisons. The day of the Lord, it'll come like a thief in the night. That's a comparison. Again, a nice comparison here. I actually had a friend who wrote his master's thesis on the biblical theology of birth pains. So he traced birth pains from Genesis to Revelation. Birth pains is almost always judgment language. It's a common way to do that. And so, again, notice that the birth pains or labor pains metaphor here is not for the believer, but for the unbeliever who's not prepared. And you can even notice Paul's kind of funny here. He points out the Romans would have prided themselves in Pax Romana, or that they had peace. Because everyone's talking about peace, but watch out when Jesus returns. Not so much for you. Again, that comparison of thief. And notice a comparison even at the end. He says, encourage one another and build one another up. And then he points out, you are doing that. So it's not like this is a new thing for the Thessalonians. That's one of the nice things about this letter. They're doing really well. Notice there's a cause and effect. Jesus died for us, or what's the purpose of that? Well, one thing that you can be sure of, because Jesus has died for you, that whether you are awake or asleep, language right here, it means, right, alive or dead. You live with him. So the believer is always alive with Christ. And that is one of the purposes of Christ dying for us. Notice there's an idea explanation, right? It's the Lord Jesus who died for us. Right, notice some contrast, right? Sudden destruction for the unbeliever, but not for you who are not in the darkness. Instead, you're in the light. Right? That's the common trend. Over and over again, it's not like work hard to be in the light. It's the believer, you already are in the light. So again, don't sleep. Stay awake. Yeah. Right, it's just a way to say, you are safe, you are saved, you will be ready, so don't live in fear of the return of Jesus. Instead, be excited for it because it's for your good. So this passage is like the most wonderful, gentle, encouraging passage on the return of Jesus, because the whole point is like, believer, are you trusting in Jesus? Great, then you're ready. Right, it's not like, you know, trust in Jesus plus like have the date figured out when he's going to return and somehow then you'll be ready or something like that. Right, and again, contrast, right, not destined for wrath, but positive, right, to obtain salvation. So you see lots of contrast. And we said we had two inferences. So we had two big ideas. One inference was right here that we found. So then let us not sleep as others do, but keep awake and be sober. And then our second one was encourage one another and build one another up. If you had to pick a grammatical main point, right, we said our system, we work through the text. If we find an inference, we know it's our main point, but then sadly, we found two, so now we have to ask, what's the broadest one? What did you pick as you were going through this for the main point of the passage? Which one of those two, 6 or 11? Which one did you pick? Yeah, absolutely, right? You could say, this is like the inference of the fact that you're in the light, right? Because you're in the light, don't sleep as others do. But even more broader, general than that, we could say, so be encouraged, right? That's the biggest idea. So again, you could say, like, why did Paul write 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 11? He wants them to encourage one another and build one another up. And then you can say, what's the specifics of that? Well, it's all these things, right? You're in the light. You will be ready. Those people who are persecuting you, right, they will get destruction. Like, that's encouraging as well, right, when you're in the heat of persecution. And so this kind of helps us to, again, just track with that biggest idea to locate it. Oh, I did put some time frames. Oh, there's some emotional languages, right? But I think that's the best place to start at. And then we said, once we find our main point, remember last time we said we just put this in past tense. So we could say something like, Paul wanted the Thessalonians to encourage one another and build one another up, right? To get that is to get the biggest idea of the passage, and then you can always go back and fill in the other things. So this is maybe somewhat what yours looked like as you were practicing your grammatical observations. So today we'll learn how to take that main point and run it through the process of interpretation. So that's where we're going today. We mentioned this in the very first day, and so it'll just be quick review here, right? The reason why we want to do this, the reason why we spent so many weeks in the text is because we want to make sure we understand what God has actually intended. We don't want to create meaning. We don't want to add things that aren't there. We want to take account of things like culture, time, situation, covenant. And at the same time, know that even though these things were written to somebody other than us, that there is indeed both meaning and application to Christians today. And so sometimes you use a picture like this, right? There's a original audience. There's original town that the text was intended for. Our goal is, once we know what the text says, to move across some sort of like principalizing bridge to say, what does it mean to us today? And then notice those roads, all the different ways that it would apply. So we would say, you know, depending on how wide of a text you pick, there's probably like one big idea and then a few sub-ideas. We wouldn't want to say that there's, you know, endless interpretations. It's not true. There's only so many things going on in the text. But we would say once you get to application, right, then it's endless. Application's like, I pretty much can't tell you you're wrong. It's like, oh, you know, I think that I should do this. Great. Sounds good, right? So we'll see how to do that today. So here would be our steps. We could say there's four steps, but sneakily I put in there a step 3.5 just to mess you up. And then you could say, why didn't you just have 5 steps? Because originally when I taught this, the method that we used had 4. And mysteriously absent in many hermeneutics books is what we, especially in the Reform tradition, love, which is what we could say is redemptive historical hermeneutics, that we don't read our Bible without thinking of how it connects to the saving work of Jesus. That's why you would like name a church, for example, right, Emmaus Road, because you love Luke 24 and you understand that all the law, the prophets, and the writings point forward to Jesus. So we always want to be keeping that in our mind. We're not forgetting how the text connects to Jesus. So we'll walk through these. We'll practice these today together so that you can see how this process would work. Now, this one is really what we've done the last 7 days, or last seven times together, right? We want to know, what did the text mean to the biblical audience? We've spent lots of time learning about grammar, significant words, right? You could read some commentaries and figure out historical literary context, things like that. Right, this is what we've spent our time on, being able to say, this is what the text says. I'm confident that that's what it says because I have all this evidence, right, as I make my grammatical observations. Once we do that, we write it out in past tense verbs. I will point out this, though. So often when we read our Bible, we're good at summarizing. In other words, I can say, you know, Jesus fed the 5,000. And that's true. That's good. That tells us what was going on in the story. But really, to know why it's in your Bible, you actually have to go one step further back. And you have to say, right, Mark included the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000 so that his first readers would what, right? Like, everything that your writer has included in the text has a particular purpose, right? Like, when you read Genesis 1, right, you'd say Moses wrote Genesis 1 so that the Israelites in the wilderness would what? Right? And you'd say, well, quickly, I know that it's probably not to tell them how old the earth is, right? Now, that's not to say that we might not, like, infer, right? If push came to shove, I'd say, well, sure, yeah, I'm probably young earth. That's probably where I'm going to lean. But you'd say, well, I can quickly see why that wouldn't be really the main focus of the text, right? How in the world would the Israelites in the wilderness be benefited by knowing how old the earth is? But you could say, wow, shows how God is sovereign over everything, right? How God rules over the whole earth, and he is the one true God. Right, now, that'd be really helpful, right? If you just left Egypt, you're tempted to go back to false gods, and you go, okay, now I can start to say, what is the purpose of this text? And so when you're reading narrative or reading anything, you would want to say, the writer, so you could just name the writer, or you could just say, the writer wanted their first readers to fill in the blank. We want to be specific, and we want to just say what the text says. So again, this is really unexciting in step one, because we're simply doing what we've been practicing. So if we said it in one phrase, we could say we want to first know what the text says. So I have an example for you. 1 Corinthians 16:20. This is a fun one to use, right? 1 Corinthians 16:20, all the brothers send you greetings, greet one another with a holy kiss. So here our writer is Paul. So we could say in past tense, Paul wanted his first readers to what? Go ahead and finish that sentence or write that down. Don't theologize it yet, right? You're going to be tempted to, like, say, well, I might not do that, so I'm going to write something different. Write what the text says, right? What the first readers of this particular letter should have gotten from it. So what did Paul want his first readers to get from this? What did you say? What did you write down? Paul wanted his first readers to what? That's true, but you've already moved it into a theological principle. There's something more specific, more culturally conditioned that Paul says. How does Paul envision that they would do that? Yeah, Paul literally says they should greet one another with a holy kiss. If you lived in Corinth and you received this letter, the way in which you would obey Paul's command is you would actually greet one another with a kiss. So we want to keep it historical. We want to keep it what the text actually says. For this first step, we want to say the writer wanted his first readers to greet one another with a holy kiss. Or in this case, we could say Paul wanted his first readers to greet one another with a holy kiss. Right? And again, this reminds us that it wasn't written to us. It was written to someone else than us. And so we have to take into account differences. And that's what step two is. That's one of the reasons why I use this one. It's a good example, a simple example. We want to look for differences such as culture, language, situation, time, covenant. Right? If you're reading in the Old Testament, you have a bigger river to jump over, you could say, than in the New Testament. Right? Paul's letters are easier because Paul's writing to Christians after the resurrection. Right? They're part of churches. In a sense, they exist in the same time that we do. right? Between the first and the second coming. Now, they certainly have cultural differences still that we have to take into account, but it's the least amount. Whereas if you're in the old covenant, right, you have to say, like, okay, like Moses is the covenant mediator, they're doing sacrifices, right? The land is like the picture of the promised land or the picture of the new heavens and new earth, and like all these other things are going on that you're going to have to like filter out eventually as you're moving to how would you apply it to a Christian today. And so we want to also consider then where the text falls in the relation to the finished work of Jesus. We want to know what the redemptive storyline of the Bible is as we're thinking about this. And this is just my nitpicky annoyance. This isn't so much for you. This is more like every chapel at our school, this is not really true, is like, be like Moses, be like David, be like Solomon. And so a healthy reminder, when you read the Old Testament especially, there are many people who hold unique, specific roles that are essentially placeholders for Jesus. And your first temptation should not be, I'm like Moses in the story, or I'm like Daniel. In a similar way, you could say, when I read the Gospels, right, and I get like the story of Jesus resurrecting Lazarus, and I say, like, who do you resonate with in that story, Dustin? If I said, like, you know, I'm Jesus, I'm the guy doing the raising, you'd go, I think you read that wrong. Like, I don't think you understand where you fit in the story. And so when I read like about Moses, the covenant mediator of Israel, it's really fun to think like, gosh, I could be like Moses, right? But that's because he's really important. Like, you and I are probably the Israelites who never got mentioned in the Old Testament, right? There's millions of them who just go on and live their day-to-day regular life. Like, in the story of David and Goliath, we're the people on the sidelines who just kind of like watch it happen, right? We're not David. We're not like the big person. These people are special placeholders for Jesus. Now, once we know that, like, at a second level, can we still learn from the life of Moses? Can we? Yeah, like, we do. We learn lots of things from them, just like we learn from the life of Jesus, but it's not a one-to-one. So we do have to be careful, especially with some of these, like, favorite people of the Old Testament, to not just, like, put ourselves in the story as that important person. We're probably somebody less significant. Yeah. 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 That's a much better way to read. Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. And like when we do our Daniel study, right, we're still learning things like how do I live as a wise person in a culture that's like not believers. Right, we learn that from the book of Daniel. We just want to be careful not to say, like, what's the main thing? Like, ooh, look at me, I'm Daniel, I'm this, like, special figure, right? Like, so we still learn that truth. We just have to be careful to not, like, go there first. If we go there second, third, fourth, right, then we're in good shape because we've kind of put it in its right place. So, yeah, identifying yourself as the sinner in the text is a really great thing to do because then you see kind of what are the consequences of sin or what are the solutions for sin in the story or a lot of other things like that. So we could say we want to measure what is the difference between us and them. Now, you could spend, like, hours, like, trying to measure differences. There's usually not that many that are important, right? You're looking for, like, significant ones that would change whatever we said in step one, right? My writer wanted his first readers to fill in the blank. If there's something that would really affect how you and I would live in accord with what we read, then we'd want to measure it. So take like 30 seconds. You can probably figure it out. What is the significant difference that we would want to take account of that's a cultural difference in 1 Corinthians 16:20? And I point out that it's cultural because if we lived in France today, we wouldn't think twice about it, right? You just go, oh yeah, we can do that. And so when we measure differences, we're measuring cultural differences that some people would say, eh, doesn't bother me. So what is the obvious difference in this particular one? Yeah, you could say we don't greet one another with a kiss, right? That's just not normal, right? If we started greeting one another with kisses in Minnesota, people would look at us a little bit weird. They'd be a little concerned about us, right? You just kind of give like the friendly like hi, something like that. Maybe you shake hands. So we do want to figure out then, so what do we do, right? What do we do with Paul's command in 1 Corinthians 16 to greet one another with a holy kiss if we don't kiss one another? And this is where we want to find what we could call a theological principle. A theological principle is something that would be true for both the original audience and us. So whatever we say in this step, you should be able to say, like, Paul wanted the Corinthians to fill in the blank. And if I say that about them, it should also work for me, right? I should be able to, like, span time both ways. And I could say, yeah, that actually works for both audiences. It fills the role of what he said when he said, greet one another with a holy kiss. But it also fills the role of what you and I should do today. So it should be relevant to both audiences. And it should be something that we can actually find in the text. So if you can't, like, point to it in the text, like, hey, I think the theological principle of 1 Corinthians 16:20 is that you should have 7 pastors on a rotating basis. You go, well, great, but there's nothing in the text that would indicate that. So I'd have to go somewhere else if I had some sort of unique theory like that or something like that. Here are some general rules of what a theological principle should be. It shouldn't be culturally bound. In other words, whatever you say in this step should be so bland that you could apply it to the church 2,000 years from now, that you could apply it all the way back to Old Testament Israel or anywhere in between, right? You're picking a very broad, general idea that then when we get to application, you'll particularize it to you and your particular culture, time, situation. So it's not culturally bound. It's not it is timeless. It should be reflected in the text. We mentioned it should go both ways, both to the original audience and to us. And it shouldn't violate something else in the whole Bible, right? So you couldn't say, like, oh, 1 Corinthians 16:20 says, greet one another with a holy kiss. Really, the theological principle is I can sleep with whoever I want. You go, well, like, that would violate, like, the rest of my New Testament. And so I'd say that's just not true. Like, that's not a good theological principle. We would write out our theological principle in one or two sentences. Now we're using present tense verbs. So previously we said, the writer wanted, past tense, his first readers to fill in the blank. Now we're essentially coming up with what we think the text means. And we might start it a few different ways. You might say Christians should. So if you're taking a New Testament text, that's really easy, right? You just say Christians should. If Paul's writing the Corinthians, they're Christians, Christians should. If you've got an Old Testament text and we really want it to be, like, precise, right? They're not Christians, but they are believers, right? So we could say believers should. And whatever we write would be able to apply both to the original first readers and to us as well. Or maybe you're reading, like I was just thinking in particular, like the pastorals, right? Some of those are written to a particular, you know, ranking person, right? Timothy is an elder in the church, so you might say pastors or elders should as well. So there might be certain times where you encounter something like that that you would want to particularize it, focusing on who it is. So in present tense, I would just say use this one. Christians should what? What would be a way to take this and turn it into a theological principle that would be true for us, true for the original audience, right? It's good for all time. 2,000 years from now it would work. It could work for a church in France. It could work for a church in Africa, right? What would be a way to say this in a broad, general way that highlights kind of the heart behind what was said? What might you say? Yeah, Christians should greet one another in any particular way? In love, sure. Christians should greet one another in love. Christians should greet one another warmly. Christians should greet one another kindly. Right? Those are really good theological principles, because what does it look to greet someone warmly, kindly, you know, in love? Well, that might vary from culture to culture. Maybe you got like a secret handshake that you always do every time you get together in some culture, right? You do that secret handshake then. Maybe you don't do secret handshakes, right? Maybe you do, like, you give a hug and then you pat that person 3 times on the back to say, hey, the hug is done. We need to move on. Like, enough's enough, right? Maybe you do that. But whatever it is, right, now they can take your theological principle and they can figure out how it would apply in their particular culture. It's not a culturally conditioned statement. All right, so let's practice another good one regularly to be biblical when I feel a little sick, my first response is, you know, really, I should probably drink some wine. That would really solve my problem. But this will help think through really some important things in the Christian life as we work our way through this. So take a second, write out past tense. What does this passage mean, or what did it mean to its original audience? So Paul wanted his first readers, or Paul wanted Tim, to do what? What could you say? What did Paul want Tim to do? Yeah, so you could say drink wine, right, when his tummy hurt or something like that, right? Poor Tim, he's got a little tummy ache, right? Notice Paul does not send him one of those anointed, like, prayer cloths that just, like, heal people in the book of Acts. This time he says, hey, you should drink some wine. Like, Paul, what happened to those prayer cloths that you had? You know, just send those bad boys around. No, he says, drink some wine that will help you with your ailment. So when Timothy feels sick, he should drink wine. So again, past tense, maybe we'd say, Paul wanted Timothy to drink wine when he felt sick. Something like that. What is obviously different? What don't you do? Unless apparently you're me, I don't really drink wine when I feel sick. What don't you do when you feel sick? What's the obvious difference? Yeah, what do you do instead? Yeah, right, when you're sick, you got a little tummy ache, you take Pepto-Bismol, maybe you got a headache, you take ibuprofen or acetaminophen. Notice how I didn't like name names for like certain drug products, you know. Really smart. Right, we do something else. When we have a stomach ache, when we're sick, we don't drink wine, we would medicate ourselves. So if we came up with a theological principle, you say Christians should what? When Christians feel sick, what should they do? Yeah, right? Right, and we're not saying like over-medicate or be too quick to medicate, but you do hear really sad stories sometimes, right? A lot of times like maybe there's parents and their child gets sick and they say like, let's just pray about it. And then they don't do anything else. And sadly, sometimes the child even dies. And you go, well, no, right? A good theological principle would be medicate yourself. And that might look a lot of different ways. It doesn't mean just take like, you know, medicine as we think about it. Maybe there are other things as well that you can do. But we would say like, don't just pray. Certainly pray about it, but use the means that God has provided. For Timothy, it was drink wine. We would say broadly, Christians should medicate themselves when they are sick. Yeah, right? Paul's telling Timothy, your stomach feels upset. In some way, I think drinking wine will help. We wouldn't do that, but right, as we just bridge that gap, we say, what would I do when I feel sick? I would take medicine, right? And so for me, it's like, I used to try to be really tough when I had a headache. And it's like, I'm not going to take ibuprofen. I'm going to, like, you know, fight it out. And it's, why? What's the point? Like, not that, again, I should be too quick to, like, over-medicate. But it's like, who am I impressing? My wife's not impressed when I, you know, say, like, oh, I'm really crabby now. And I got this bad headache. But, hey, I didn't take ibuprofen, huh? It's like, well, the Lord has provided that for us. All right, here's our in-between step. And this is important because before we move from a theological principle, you could say, like, Christians should greet one another with love. You could quickly turn that into moralism, couldn't you? Like, you better do it. You better just be a really good person. Yeah, otherwise Santa Claus is not going to give you, you know, a nice gift. You're going to get coal. You know, in some senses, you wonder if Halloween is more Christian than Christmas, because whether you're good or bad, everybody gets candy at Halloween, don't they? Right, like, there's a sense in which you go, wow, that's kind of like, you know, obviously there's all kinds of other questions with Halloween you might not like, and that's fine. But I do think of it that way, like, wow, you know. So we don't want to be just moralists. We want to know, what is my motivation for being obedient? And even more so, like, where is my righteousness? Well, it's not in, like, how well I greet one another in love, but in some way, my greeting one another in love, that righteousness comes from Jesus and his perfect life. And so we want to be really good at just thinking about what we're reading and connecting it to Jesus. And this goes both forwards and backwards. If you're in the Old Testament, you're probably used to saying, like, how does my text point forward to Jesus? I would suggest that when you read in the New Testament, you learn really well how to figure out how to go backwards to the life of Jesus in the Gospels. Right? You think in Colossians, Paul says, like, let your words always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Who does that perfectly? Or that's Jesus, right? Like, that's his righteousness. Or like Ephesians says, to be redeemers of time. That we need to use our time wisely and effectively, right, for the glory of God. Well, who did that best? Well, that's Jesus, right? Like, he's the perfect fulfillment of all of those commands or imperatives in the New Testament. And so as you learn the Gospels well, you're able to connect backwards, saying like, oh, here's all these commands of what I should do. And I can be reminded that I find my ultimate righteousness, not in how well I do it, but Jesus, and then that leads me even more to want to pursue that, to do it well, and to love it well. So I have up here, to avoid simply being moralistic, we should really ask first how the text points us towards Jesus, what he has done, who he is, how he is the truest fulfillment of the text. because we're in Christ, we can then ask how this applies to us. You could call this like the gospel-centered way of reading scripture. That's like really like the hot word these days. I would say in the Reformed tradition, we use fun words like this is redemptive historical hermeneutics. I know that sounds really fancy. Redemptive historical, the storyline of the Bible, hermeneutics, like how to read. In other words, we read every text in light of how the whole story is going on. So when people ask me, like, do you like grammatical historical hermeneutics? Usually I just politely say, yeah, sure, that's pretty much what I do. But not really, right? We're actually more nitpicky. We have nuance in our theological tradition. And we say we do grammar, we do history, we do all those things, but we actually add one more element, which is I don't want to read an Old Testament text and simply know all the details about that text but not know how it fits in the storyline of the Bible. That could be disastrous. In fact, that's what Jesus corrects, right, in that time between his resurrection and his ascension. How do I read my Bible, making sure that it points to him? And so we want to get the storyline of the Bible so that we're always arcing our story into where it fits with Jesus and his saving work. Some guy named Chuck Spurgeon once said of preachers, "Don't you know, young man, that from every town and every village and every hamlet in England, wherever it may be, there is a road to London? So from every text of Scripture, there is a road to Christ. And my dear brother, your business is, when you get to a text, to say, now what is the road to Christ? I've never found a text that had not got a road to Christ in it. And if I ever do find one, I will go over hedge and ditch, but I would get at my master, for the sermon cannot do any good unless there is a savor of Christ in it." And I would say not just for the person giving the sermon, but for you and your individual Bible reading, right? If you read a text and you never connect it back to the saving work of Christ, the implication in Luke 24 is that you actually don't know what you read, right? Before the disciples were connecting the text to Jesus' saving work, Jesus says they didn't understand. But once they did that, then they did. And so we want to be good understanders of the Bible and making sure that we know how it connects to him. So we could say this, we want to determine how the text connects to Christ's saving work. We could use phrases like Jesus was, Jesus is, Jesus did, something like that. We're probably going to start with Jesus, right? And then try to find a creative way in which our minds get turning to say, how is Jesus the fulfillment of this text? How do I find my righteousness in him? How is he the true, the ultimate version of this? Something like that. Some will be really easy because they'll be just really explicit. It's about Jesus. But the other ones, you'll have to wrestle with it a little bit. Now, I thought we could do story time, if you'll bear with me. This is a good example of how to do it in the Old Testament. And I could point out, when we're looking for ways to connect to Jesus, we're not looking for Jesus under every rock. It's not like, you know, in the Old Testament, the tent peg was like pounded into the ground, and hey, Jesus had nails pounded into his hands, and so the tent pegs are a picture of Jesus. We're looking for like those big themes, the big ideas, and how they find their fulfillment in Jesus. If it's a good connector to Jesus, it's probably like repeated multiple times throughout the Old Testament. Maybe even your New Testament writer picks up on it, right? As you read your New Testament writers, you start to learn the way in which they use the Old Testament, and we can learn from them. We should be able to say, whatever they do with the Old Testament, I should be able to recreate that, right? I can't say as confidently like this is Jesus in the Old Testament, but I can say, boy, sure looks like it based on how my New Testament writers use their Old Testament, right? Jude, for example, says Jesus led the Israelites out of Egypt. Really? Like, I don't remember that in the story of the Exodus. Like, Jesus led them out? And the answer is, well, yeah, because he sees the story of the Exodus as such a picture of salvation. He says, I can understand that as a precursor to the ultimate salvation, which is in Christ. And so we want to be sensitive to the big themes that are going to get us there. While still being cautious to not like make everything Jesus and ruin the original meaning of the text. All right, here we go. This is called A Giant Staircase to Heaven. It says this: Noah and his family lived in the land, and his children had children, and those children had more children, and then those children had even more. Well, you get the picture, until there were lots of people on earth once more. Now, back then, everybody spoke exactly the same language, so you didn't need to learn Swahili or Japanese or anything, because you could say hello to anyone, and they knew what you meant. One day, everyone was talking, and they came up with an idea. Let's build ourselves a beautiful city to live in. It can be our home, and we'll be safe forever and ever. Then they had another idea. Let's build a really tall tower to reach up to heaven. By the way, you could say Children's Bible, right? They're using the summary method of interpreting, right? They're summarizing what's in the story for us so that we can get the main details without, you know, having all of the challenging words for a child. "Yes," they said, "we'll say, look at us up here, and everyone will look up at us, and we'll look down on them. And then we'll know we are something. We'll be like God. We'll be famous and safe and happy and everything. We'll be all right." So they got to work. Brick by brick, the tower grew higher and higher until it soared above the city, touching the sky. They built stairs in the tower to climb up to the top. It was like a giant staircase to heaven. "Look," they cheered, "we're the ones. See what we can do with our very own hands." They were quite pleased with themselves. But God was not pleased with them. God could see what they were doing. They were trying to live without him, but God knew that wouldn't make them happy or safe or anything. If they kept on like this, they would only destroy themselves, and God loved them too much to let that happen. So he stopped their plans. One morning, they went to work as usual, but everything was different. Their words were all new and funny. You see, God had given each person a completely different language. Suddenly, no one understood what anyone else was saying. Someone would say, "How do you do?" And the other person thought they said, "How ugly are you?" It wasn't funny. You could be saying something nice, like, "Such a lovely morning," and get a punch in the nose because they thought you said, "Hush up, you're boring." You couldn't even say, "Pardon," to check if you heard right, because no one understood that word either. It wasn't easy to work together after that, as you can only imagine. People were always quarreling and fighting and getting in a dreadful muddle and becoming grumpier and grumpier, until at last they were all too cross to keep on building and just had to stop. After that, people scattered all over the world, which is how we ended up with so many different languages to this day. Now, you could stop right there and you say, "That's the story of the Tower of Babel. I've summarized it well. I know what's going on. Great." We say, "Well, no. What's the big idea of the Tower of Babel?" Now, interestingly, the Tower of Babel forms one of those things we talked about last time, a chiasm, or two times ago. And in the very middle of the chiasm, the biggest idea of the Tower of Babel is that God came down, right? In this case, in the Tower of Babel, God came down in judgment, right? Scattered them, sent them out. Well, our writer, she's thoughtful. She says this: "You see, God knew however high they reached, however hard they tried, people could never get back to heaven by themselves. People didn't need a staircase, they needed a rescuer. Because the way back to heaven wasn't a staircase, it was a person. People could never reach up to heaven, so heaven would have to come down to them. And one day it would." Right? So we're saying, oh, I noticed a big theme, a big idea in Tower of Babel, right? God came down. Is there another point in the Bible where God came down? Well, yeah. Now I'm thinking life of Jesus. This is when God comes down, this time not in judgment, but in his saving work. And there are lots of ways that you can go from old to new, or from New Testament commands back to the life of Jesus. So you're looking for, you know, is there a person who's a picture of Christ? And they do it successfully. Joseph, right? Joseph is so mysteriously perfect, right? He seems to always do what's right, and then he suffers, and yet, even in the midst of his suffering, he's raised up to the right hand of power, only to forgive those who sold him, right, over to death. You go, boy, that sounds really familiar, right? Now, we know Joseph isn't actually perfect, but we could say he's literally perfect, right? He never sins in that story. He seems to always do what's right, and we say, boy, that points us forward. Or you look at, like, the imperfect example. You read the book of Judges, right? And it's like all of these are individuals who save Israel, right? It tells you that God can save his people with one person. But they don't do it very well, right? You get, like, left-handed guys who stab fat kings, and then it goes, like, all the way up to his arm, and it's really gross, and it's like ultimate boy stories. And you go, I mean, yeah, he saved his people, but, like, couldn't you do it in a better way, like a kinder way? Is there not, like, a better form of redemption than this? And it doesn't really last. In fact, Judges, it just gets worse and worse. Like, is there ever going to be, like, a permanent person? Or you could say incompleteness is a huge theme in the Old Testament, right? That every time, like, they do something, they try something, and it just really doesn't last. You say, when will somebody come and make it last, make it work, fix things forever? So you're looking for those big themes that you can trace and find fulfillment in Jesus. And then finally, here would be our last step. We could say this. We want to know, how should individual Christians today apply the theological principles? So step one would be past tense. The original writer wanted their first readers to fill in the blank. We measure the differences. Step two, matching that, you would say Christians should, and you're picking up that same language of the first one. Connect it to Jesus. You say, Jesus is the fulfillment of this in some way, shape, or form, right? We think of our medicine one, which is really weird, like Christians should medicate themselves. You could say, like, what is our ultimate medicine for sin, death, disease, like Christ, right? You can make connections like that. I would suggest that you can let your mind be creative. We wouldn't be too nitpicky as you try to find ways to be thoughtful and connected to Jesus. And then you would say, okay, now how do I apply this? In other words, what does this look like in my culture? So I went from their culture to like a neutral statement to now a very culturally specific, in fact, a personally specific, like I should this, right? When you say that, I go, well, I don't think that. You said Matthew 28, I should go and be a missionary. And I go, I wasn't thinking that at all. Like, I was thinking I should read some books on missions to become more familiar with it. Or, ooh, I should support some missionaries. Or, ooh, you know, I have a friend who is a missionary and I'd like to pray for them, right? Like, I'm coming up with all these different things about a text on missions, right? Not because the text means something different, but because the way in which it would look in my life, I would apply it differently. You might call this significance. This is where people get confused when they say a text can mean anything, or they say there's multiple meanings in a text. No. Well, there really isn't, but there's multiple applications or countless applications in a text, and I think that's usually what people are trying to get at when they say that. They're not really saying, like, you can just, like, make the Bible say whatever you want it to say. Their language is just maybe imprecise in that way. So we would want to say there's really only, like, a certain amount of meaning that you can find based on what the original writers intended, but there is countless significance as you figure out what does that look like in your life or how does it apply to you. So we could say this. Lastly, we want to determine how the text applies to us. All right. So if we were running through this one, we get at the very end of the list. Right now it's I should. So how could you take this from your theological principle, which is Christians should greet one another in love or Christians should greet one another warmly, and turn this into a personal application? What might this say? I should what? Perfect, right? Just make a point. I should make a point to say hello, how are you, to somebody that I see at church today, right? I should make a point to shake Glenn's hand because he will appreciate it, right, if I do that when I see them this morning. If I give him a holy kiss, I might get like a little rap on the face. It's not going to go well. But a handshake and Glenn will say, oh, good, like Dustin loves me, he cares about me. That's a warm greeting. Right? So you notice, like, your application might even be different from, like, person to person, right? You might meet somebody and the way that you greet them warmly would be different than somebody else. And so you're thinking about, how can I apply this? How might you apply a text like this, 1 Timothy 5:23, right? We said our theological principle is Christians should medicate themselves when they're sick. What could you say? Yeah, I should go to the doctor if I need to, right? Don't try to be too tough. I think that's men especially, like, I don't need the doctor, I'm fine. It'll just heal on its own. Right? Go to the doctor, you know. There's wisdom. How much money do you really want to spend? All those things, I understand. But yeah, like, doctors are not the enemy. That might be a good application for some of us here today. Others of you might say, I never thought that anyways. Great, right? You come up with a different significance or application for yourself. All right, so here's what I have for you. Our last one. For this style of interpreting is Psalm 1. This is fun that we've got lots of different people reading, thinking about Psalm 1. The kids are memorizing it. I would say the method that we have learned, I wanted to show you one method all the way through first, works essentially for any sort of like organized, structured argument thought. So it could work for the Psalms, it could work for the prophets, it could work for letters in the New Testament. Essentially all of them function the same way. What we'll do next week is then we'll tweak it and we'll say, what would we do with a narrative, right? Because that's the one that stands out as different. How do I take all these observations, all the things that I've learned, and tweak it and say, how do I read a story and ask how a story fits in a set of stories in an entire book? So that's what we'll do next time, but I wanted to give you an example of something other than a letter, and you'll see how Psalm 1 will work really nicely. It's got contrast, it's got a strong inference that will guide you to the biggest idea. Right, it's going to have main clauses, subordinate clauses. Of course, when you're reading a psalm, you get lots of imagery, so you got figures of speech or things like that. As usual, I've provided you two options. I've got the easy one in which I try to guide you. I try to box in those key conjunctions, key words for you along the way so that you can try to find them. I've got the medium one, which just has the checklist. Maybe you're really brave at this point and you can say, I'm just going to use the one that you originally gave me that's just the text in there. You'd be really brave if you did that. But those are there for you. And then next time we'll get together, we'll talk about Psalm 1, and then we'll transition and say, how do we do this with a narrative? And that essentially will give us a good framework to start asking good questions about how to read, how to interpret all of those different things. Let me pray, and then we'll get you out of here. Lord, thank you so much for your word. Thank you so much that you, as the ultimate author, have made it so that we can understand it, that you have spoken to us in baby talk so that we might understand who you are and what you are like, that had you simply spoken on your own, we would never understand it, that it would be too high for us, but you have accommodated your language so that we might know you and love you and obey you, and most of all, that we might trust in your Son. And we pray that as we read your word, that our hearts would be increased in that, and that we would grow in our love for you and our love for others. We praise in Jesus' name. Amen. So feel free to